The next day things were almost normal, although none of the children followed Nort. The day after that, the cat calls resumed. Life had gotten back on its own sweet keel. The uprooted corn was gathered together by the children, and a week after Nort's resurrection, they burned it in the middle of the street. The fire was momentarily bright, and most of the barflies stepped or staggered out to watch. They looked primitive. Their faces seemed to float between the flames and the ice-chip brilliance of the sky. Allie watched them, and felt a pang of fleeting despair for the sad times of this world. The loss. Things had stretched apart. There was no glue at the center anymore. Somewhere, something was tottering, and when it fell, all would end. She had never seen the ocean. Never would. "If I had guts," she murmured. "If I had guts. Guts. Guts." Nort raised his head at the sound of her voice, and smiled emptily at her from hell. She had no guts, only a bar and a scar and a word. It struggled behind her closed lips. Suppose she were to call him over now and draw him close, despite his stink. Suppose she said the word into the waxy bugger lug he called an ear. His eyes would change. They would turn into his eyes, those of the man in the robe. And then Nort would tell what he'd seen in the land of death, what lay beyond the earth and the worms. "I'll never say that word to him." But the man who had brought Nort back to life and left her a note, left her a word like a cocked pistol she would someday put to her temple, had known better. 19 would open the secret. 19 was the secret. She caught herself writing it in a puddle on the bar. 19. And skidded it to nothingness when she saw Nort watching her. The fire burned down rapidly, and her customers came back in. She began to dose herself with the star whiskey, and by midnight, she was blackly drunk. 8. She ceased her narrative, and when he made no immediate comment, she thought at first that the story had put him to sleep. She began to drowse herself when he asked, "That's all?"
"Yes, that's all. It's very late."
"Hmm." He was rolling another cigarette.
"Don't go getting your tobacco dandruff in my bed," she told him, more sharply than she had intended.
"No." Silence again. The tip of his cigarette winked off and on.
"You'll be leaving in the morning,"
she said dully. "I should. I think he's left a trap for me here. Just like he left one for you."
"Do you really think that number would—"
"If you like your sanity, you don't ever want to say that word to Nort," the gunslinger said. "Put it out of your head. If you can, teach yourself that the number after 18 is 20. That half of 38 is 17. The man who signed himself Walter O'Dim is a lot of things, but a liar isn't one of them. But when the urge comes and it's strong, come up here and hide under your quilts and say it over and over again. Scream it if you have to, until the urge passes."
"A time will come when it won't pass."
The gunslinger made no reply, for he knew this was true. The trap had a ghastly perfection. If someone told you you'd go to hell if you thought about seeing your mother naked... Once, when the gunslinger was very young, he had been told this very thing. You'd eventually do it. And why? Because you did not want to imagine your mother naked. Because you did not want to go to hell. Because if given a knife and a hand in which to hold it, the mind would eventually eat itself. Not because it wanted to. Because it did not want to. Sooner or later, Allie would call Nort over and say the word.
"Don't go," she said.
"We'll see." He turned on his side away from her, but she was comforted.
he would stay, at least for a little while. She drowsed. On the edge of sleep, she thought again about the way Nort had addressed him in that strange talk. It was the only time she had seen her strange new lover express emotion. Even his lovemaking had been a silent thing. And only at the last had his breathing roughened and then stopped for a second or two. He was like something out of a fairy tale or a myth, a fabulous, dangerous creature. Could he grant wishes? She thought the answer was yes, and that she would have hers. He would stay a while. That was wish enough for a luckless, scarred bitch such as she. Tomorrow was time enough to think of another, or a third. She slept. 9. In the morning she cooked him grits, which he ate without comment. He shoveled them in without thinking about her, hardly seeing her. He knew he should go. Every minute he sat here, the man in black was further away, probably out of the hard pan and arroyos and into the desert by now. His path had been undeviatingly southeast, and the gunslinger knew why. "Do you have a map?" he asked, looking up. "Of the town?" she laughed. "There isn't enough of it to need a map." "No, of what's southeast of here?" Her smile faded. "The desert. Just the desert. I thought you'd stay for a little." "What's on the other side of the desert?"
"How would I know? Nobody crosses it. Nobody's tried since I was here."
She wiped her hands on her apron, got potholders, and dumped the tub of water she had been heating into the sink, where it splashed and steamed.
"The clouds all go that way. It's like something sucks them."
He got up.
"Where are you going?"
She heard the shrill fear in her voice and hated it. "To the stable. If anyone knows, the hostler will." He put his hands on her shoulders. The hands were hard, but they were also warm. "And to arrange for my mule. If I'm going to be here, he should be taken care of. For when I leave."
"But not yet." She looked up at him. "But you watch that, Kennelly. If he doesn't know a thing, he'll make it up."
"Thank you, Allie." When he left, she turned to the sink, feeling the hot, warm drift of her grateful tears. How long since anyone had thanked her? Someone who mattered. 10. Kennelly was a toothless and unpleasant old satyr who had buried two wives and was plagued with daughters. Two half-grown ones peeked at the gunslinger from the dusty shadows of the barn. A baby drooled happily in the dirt. A full-grown one, blonde, dirty, and sensual, watched with a speculative curiosity as she drew water from the groaning pump beside the building. She caught the gunslinger's eye, pinched her nipples between her fingers, dropped him a wink, and then went back to pumping. The hostler met him halfway between the door to his establishment and the street. His manner vacillated between a kind of hateful hostility and craven fawning.
"It's being cared for, never fear it," he said,
and before the gunslinger could reply, Kennelly turned on his daughter with his fists up, a desperate, scrawny rooster of a man.
"You get in, Subie! You get right the hell in!"
Subie began to drag her bucket sullenly toward the shack appended to the barn. "You meant my mule," the gunslinger said.
"Yes, sire. Ain't seen no mule in quite a time, especially one that looks as threaded as yourn. Two eyes, four legs."
His face squinched together alarmingly in an expression meant to convey either extreme pain or the notion that a joke had been made. The gunslinger assumed it was the latter, although he had little or no sense of humor himself.
"Time was they used to grow up wild for want of 'em," Kennelly continued. "But the world has moved on. Ain't seen nothing but a few muty oxen and the coach horses and Subie, I'll wear you, for God."
"I don't bite," the gunslinger said pleasantly. Kennelly cringed and grinned. The gunslinger saw the murder in his eyes quite clearly, and although he did not fear it, he marked it as a man might mark a page in a book, one that contained potentially valuable instructions.
"It ain't you, gods, no, it ain't you," He grinned loosely. "She just naturally gawky. She got a devil. She wild."
His eyes darkened.
"It's coming to last times, mister. You know how it says in the book, children won't obey their parents, and a plague will be visited on the multitudes. You only have to listen to the preacher woman to know it."
The gunslinger nodded, then pointed southeast. "What's out there?"
Kennelly grinned again, showing gums and a few sociable yellow teeth.
"Dwellers! Weed, desert. What else?"
He cackled, and his eyes measured the gunslinger coldly.
"How big is the desert?"
"Big."
Kennelly endeavored to look serious, as if answering a serious question.
"Maybe 1,000 wheels, maybe 2,000. I can't tell you, mister. There's nothing out there but devil grass and maybe demons. Heard there was a speaking ring somewhere on the far side. But that is probably a lie. That's the way the other fellow went. The one who fixed up Naughty when he was sick."
"Sick? I heard he was dead." Kennelly kept grinning.
"Well, well, maybe. But we're grown-up men, ain't we?"
"But you believe in demons."
Kennelly looked affronted.
"That's a lot different. Preacher woman says..."
He blathered and palavered ever onward. The gunslinger took off his hat and wiped his forehead. The sun was hot, beating steadily. Kennelly seemed not to notice. Kennelly had a lot to say, none of it sensible. In the thin shadow by the livery, the baby girl was gravely smearing dirt on her face. The gunslinger finally grew impatient and cut the man off in mid-spate. "You don't know what's after the desert?" Kennelly shrugged.
"Some might. The coach ran through part of it 50 years ago. My pap said so. He used to say 'twas mountains. Others say an ocean, a green ocean with monsters. And some say that's where the world ends, that there ain't nothing but lights that'll drive a man blind in the face of God with his mouth open to eat him up."
"Drivel," the gunslinger said shortly.
"Sure it is,"
Kennelly cried happily. He cringed again, hating, fearing, wanting to please. "You see, my mule is looked after." He flicked Kennelly another coin, which Kennelly caught on the fly. The gunslinger thought of the way a dog will catch a ball.
"Surely. You staying a little?"
"I guess I might. There'll be water."
"If God wills it. Sure, sure."
Kennelly laughed unhappily, and his eyes went on wanting the gunslinger stretched out dead at his feet.
"That alley's pretty nice when she wants to be, ain't she?"
The hustler made a loose circle with his left fist and began poking his right finger rapidly in and out of it.
"Did you say something?"
the gunslinger asked remotely. Sudden terror dawned in Kennelly's eyes, like twin moons coming over the horizon. He put his hands behind his back like a naughty child caught with the jam jar.
"No, shy, not a word, and I'm right sorry if I did."
He caught sight of Subi leaning out a window and whirled on her.
"I'll whale you now, you little slut whore! 'Fore God, I'll—"
The gunslinger walked away, aware that Kennelly had turned to watch him, aware of the fact that he could whirl and catch the hostler with some true and untinctured emotion distilled on his face. Why bother? It was hot, and he knew what the emotion would be. Just hate. Hate of the outsider. He'd gotten all the man had to offer. The only sure thing about the desert was its size. The only sure thing about the town was that it wasn't all played out here. Not yet. XI He and Allie were in bed when Sheb kicked the door open and came in with the knife. It had been 4 days, and they had gone by in a blinking haze. He ate, he slept, he had sex with Allie. He found that she played the fiddle, and he made her play it for him. She sat by the window in the milky light of daybreak, only a profile, and played something haltingly that might have been good if she'd had some training. He felt a growing but strangely absent-minded affection for her, and thought this might be the trap the man in black had left behind. He walked out sometimes. He thought very little about everything. He didn't hear the little piano player come up. His reflexes had sunk. That didn't seem to matter either, although it would have frightened him badly in another time and place. Allie was naked, the sheet below her breasts, and they were preparing to make love.
"Please,"
she was saying, "like before, I want that. I want..." The door crashed open, and the piano player made his ridiculous, knock-kneed run for the sun. Allie did not scream, although Sheb held an 8-inch carving knife in his hand. He was making a noise, an inarticulate blabbering. He sounded like a man being drowned in a bucket of mud. Spittle flew. He brought the knife down with both hands, and the gunslinger caught his wrists and turned them. The knife went flying. Sheb made a high, screeching noise like a rusty screen door. His hands fluttered in marionette movements, both wrists broken. The wind gritted against the window. Allie's looking-glass on the wall, faintly clouded and distorted, reflected the room. "She was mine," he wept. "She was mine first, mine!" Allie looked at him and got out of bed. She put on a wrapper, and the gunslinger felt a moment of empathy for a man who must be seeing himself coming out on the far end of what he once had. He was just a little man. And the gunslinger suddenly knew where he had seen him before. Known him before. "It was for you," Sheb sobbed. "It was only for you, Allie. It was you first, and it was all for you. Oh, God, dear God!" The words dissolved into a paroxysm of unintelligibilities, finally to tears. He rocked back and forth, holding his broken wrists to his belly.
"Shh, let me see." She knelt beside him. "Broken? Sheb, you ass, how will you make your living now? Didn't you know you were never strong?"
She helped him to his feet. He tried to hold his hands to his face, but they would not obey, and he wept nakedly.
"Come on over to the table and let me see what I can do."
She led him to the table and set his wrists with slats of kindling from the firebox. He wept weakly and without volition.
"Magis," the gunslinger said, and the little piano player looked around, eyes wide.
The gunslinger nodded, amiably enough now that Sheb was no longer trying to stick a knife in his lights.
"Magis," he said again. "On the clean sea."
"What about it?"
"You were there, weren't you? Many and many a, as they did say."
"What if I was? I don't remember you."
"But you remember the girl, don't you? The girl named Susan? And Reap Knight?" His voice took on an edge. "Were you there for the bonfire?"
The little man's lips trembled. They were covered with spit. His eyes said he knew the truth. He was closer to dead now than when he'd come bursting in with a knife in his hand.
"Get out of here,"
the gunslinger said. Understanding dawned in Sheb's eyes.
"But you was just a boy. One of them three boys. You come to count stock, and Eldred Jonas was there, the coffin hunter, and..."
"Get out while you still can,"
the gunslinger said, and Sheb went, holding his broken wrists before him. She came back to the bed.
"What was that about?"
"Never mind," he said.
"All right. Then where were we?"
"Nowhere."
He rolled on his side, away from her.
She said patiently, "You knew about him and me. He did what he could, which wasn't much, and I took what I could because I had to. There's nothing to be done. What else is there?"
She touched his shoulder.
"Except I'm glad that you're so strong."
"Not now," he said.
"Who was she?"
And then answering her own question,
"A girl you loved."
"Leave it, Allie."
"I can make you strong."
"No," he said. "You can't do that."
The next night the bar was closed. It was whatever passed for the Sabbath in Tull. The gunslinger went to the tiny, leaning church by the graveyard while Allie washed tables with strong disinfectant and rinsed kerosene lamp chimneys in soapy water. An odd purple dusk had fallen, and the church, lit from the inside, looked almost like a blast furnace from the road.
"I don't go,"
Allie had said shortly.
"The woman who preaches has poison religion. Let the respectable ones go."
He stood in the vestibule, hidden in a shadow, looking in. The pews were gone, and the congregation stood. He saw Kennelly and his brood. Kastner, owner of the town's scrawny dry goods emporium, and his slat-sided wife. A few barflies, a few town women he had never seen before, and, surprisingly, Sheb. They were singing a hymn, raggedly, a cappella. He looked curiously at the mountainous woman at the pulpit. Allie had said she lives alone, hardly ever sees anybody. Only comes out on Sunday to serve up the hellfire. Her name is Sylvia Pittston. She's crazy, but she's got the hoodoo on them. They like it that way. It suits them. No description could take the measure of the woman. Breasts like earthworks. A huge pillar of a neck overtopped by a pasty white moon of a face, in which blinked eyes so large and so dark that they seemed to be bottomless tarns. Her hair was a beautiful rich brown, and it was piled atop her head in a haphazard sprawl, held by a hairpin almost big enough to be a meat skewer. She wore a dress that seemed to be made of burlap. The arms that held the hymnal were slabs. Her skin was creamy, unmarked, lovely. He thought that she must top 300 pounds. He felt a sudden red lust for her that made him feel shaky. And he turned his head and looked away.
Shall we gather at the river, the beautiful, the river? Shall we gather at the river that flows by the kingdom of God?
The last note of the last chorus faded off, and there was a moment of shuffling and coughing. She waited. When they were settled, she spread her hands over them as if in benediction. It was an evocative gesture.
My dear little brothers and sisters in Christ.
It was a haunting line. For a moment the gunslinger felt mixed feelings of nostalgia and fear, stitched in with an eerie feeling of déjà vu. He thought, I dreamed this. Or I was here before. If so, when? Not Medjis. No, not there. He shook the feeling off. The audience, perhaps 25 all told, had become dead silent. Every eye touched the preacher woman.
The subject of our meditation tonight is the interloper.
Her voice was sweet, melodious, the speaking voice of a well-trained contralto. A little rustle ran through the audience.
I feel,
Sylvia Pittston said reflectively,
that I know almost everyone in the Good Book, personally. In the last 5 years, I have worn out 3 of them, precious though any book be in this ill world, and unaccountable numbers before that. I love the story, and I love the players in that story. I have walked arm in arm in the lion's den with Daniel. I stood with David when he was tempted by Bathsheba as she bathed at the pool. I have been in the fiery furnace, with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I slew 2,000 with Samson when he swung the jawbone, and was blinded with St. Paul on the road to Damascus. I wept with Mary at Golgotha.
A soft, shurring sigh in the audience.
I have known and loved them. There is only one, she held up a finger, only one player in the greatest of all dramas that I do not know. Only one who stands outside with his face in the shadow. Only one who makes my body tremble and my spirit quail. I fear him. I don't know his mind, and I fear him. I fear the interloper.
Another sigh. One of the women had put a hand over her mouth, as if to stop a sound, and was rocking, rocking.
The interloper, who came to Eve as a snake on its belly in the dust, grinning and writhing. The interloper who walked among the children of Israel while Moses was up on the mount, who whispered to them to make a golden idol, a golden calf, and to worship it with foulness and fornication.
moans, nods.
The interloper. He stood on the balcony with Jezebel and watched as King Ahaz fell screaming to his death. And he and she grinned as the dogs gathered and lapped up his blood. Oh, my little brothers and sisters, watch thou for the interloper.
Yes, oh Jesus.
This was the man the gunslinger had first noticed coming into town, the one with the straw hat.
He's always been there, my brothers and sisters. But I don't know his mind, and you don't know his mind. Who could understand the awful darkness that swirls there, the pride and the titanic blasphemy, the unholy glee, and the madness, the gibbering madness that walks and crawls and wriggles through men's most awful wants and desires?
Oh, Jesus, Savior,
it was him who took our Lord up on the mountain.
Yes,
it was him that tempted him and shewed him all the world and the world's pleasures.
Yes,
it's him that will return when last times come on the world. And they are coming, my brothers and sisters. Can't you feel they are?
Yes.
Rocking and sobbing, the congregation became a sea. The woman seemed to point at all of them and none of them.
It's him that will come as the Antichrist, a crimson king with bloody eyes, to lead men into the flaming bowels of perdition, to the bloody end of wickedness, as star wormwood hangs blazing in the sky, as gall gnaws at the vitals of the children, as women's wombs give forth monstrosities, as the works of men's hands turn to blood. Ah, ah, God!
Blah!
A woman fell on the floor, her legs crashing up and down against the wood. One of her shoes flew off.
It's him that stands behind every fleshly pleasure, him who made the machines with La Merc stamped on them, him, the interloper.
La Merc, the gunslinger thought. Or maybe she said, the mark. The word had some vague resonance for him, but nothing he could put his finger on. Nonetheless, he filed it away in his memory, which was capacious.
Yes, Lord,
they were screaming. A man fell on his knees, holding his head and braying.
When you take a drink, who holds the bottle?
The interloper.
When you sit down to a faro or a watch-me table, who turns the cards?
The interloper.
When you riot in the flesh of another's body, when you pollute yourself with your solitary hand, to whom do you sell your soul?
Oh, Jesus! Oh, Loper!
Oh! Oh! Oh!
And who is he? She cried. But calm within, he could sense the calmness, the mastery, the control and domination. He thought suddenly, with terror and absolute surety, that the man who called himself Walter had left a demon in her. She was haunted. He felt the hot ripple of sexual desire again through his fear, and thought this was somehow like the word the man in black had left in Allie's mind, like a loaded trap. The man who was holding his head crashed and blundered forward.
"I'm in hell!"
he screamed up at her, his face twisted and writhed, as if snakes crawled beneath his skin.
I done fornications, I done gambling, I done weed, I done sins, I...
But his voice rose skyward in a dreadful hysterical wail that drowned articulation. He held his head as if it would burst like an overripe cantaloupe at any moment. The audience stilled as if a cue had been given, frozen in their half-erotic poses of ecstasy. Sylvia Pitston reached down and grasped his head. The man's cry ceased as her fingers, strong and white, unblemished and gentle, worked through his hair. He looked up at her dumbly.
"Who was with you in sin?"
she asked. Her eyes looked into his, deep enough, gentle enough, cold enough to drown in.
The interloper.
Called who?
Called Lord High Satan.
Raw, oozing whisper.
Will you renounce?
Eagerly,
"Yes, yes, oh, my Jesus, Savior!"
She rocked his head. He stared at her with the blank, shiny eyes of the zealot.
"If he walked through that door,"
she hammered a finger at the vestibule shadows where the gunslinger stood,
"would you renounce him to his face?"
"On my mother's name!"
Do you believe in the eternal love of Jesus? He began to weep.
You fucking A, I do.
He forgives you that, Johnson.
Praise God,
Johnson said, still weeping. I know he forgives you, just as I know he will cast out the unrepentant from his palaces and into the place of burning darkness beyond the end of end world. Praise God. The congregation drained, spoke it solemnly. Just as I know this interloper, this Satan, this lord of flies and serpents, will be cast down and crushed. Will you crush him if you see him, Johnson?
Yes, and praise God,
Johnson wept, with both feet. Will you crush him if you see him, brothers and sisters?
Yes,
sated. If you see him sashaying down Main Street tomorrow,
praise God.
The gunslinger faded back out the door and headed for town. The smell of the desert was clear in the air. Almost time to move on. Almost. 13. In bed again.
She won't see you, Allie said. She sounded frightened. She doesn't see anybody. She only comes out on Sunday evenings to scare the hell out of everybody.
How long has she been here?
12 years, or maybe only 2. Time's funny, as thou knows. Let's not talk about her.
Where did she come from? Which direction?
I don't know.
Lying. Allie?
I don't know.
Allie?
All right. All right, she came from the dwellers, from the desert.
I thought so. He relaxed a little. Southeast, in other words. Along the path he followed. The one he could even see in the sky sometimes. And he guessed the preacher woman had come a lot further than from the dwellers or even the desert. How had she traveled so far? By way of some old machine that still worked? A train, mayhap? Where does she live?
Her voice dropped a notch. If I tell you, will you make love to me?
I'll make love to you anyway, but I want to know.
Allie sighed. It was an old yellow sound, like turning pages.
She has a house over the knoll in back of the church, a little shack. It's where the real minister used to live until he moved out. Is that enough? Are you satisfied?
No. Not yet. And he rolled on top of her.
14. It was the last day, and he knew it. The sky was an ugly, bruised purple, weirdly lit from above with the first fingers of dawn. Allie moved about like a wraith, lighting lamps, tending corn fritters that sputtered in the skillet. He had loved her hard after she had told him what he had to know. And she had sensed the coming end, and had given more than she had ever given. And she had given it with desperation against the coming of dawn, given it with the tireless energy of 16. But she was pale this morning, on the brink of menopause again. She served him without a word. He ate rapidly, chewing, swallowing, chasing each bite with hot coffee. Allie went to the bat wings and stood staring out at the morning, at the silent battalions of slow-moving clouds.
It's going to dust up today.
I'm not surprised.
Are you ever?
She asked ironically, and turned to watch him get his hat. He clapped it on his head and brushed past her.
Sometimes,
he told her. He only saw her once more alive. 15. By the time he reached Sylvia Pittston's shack, the wind had died utterly, and the whole world seemed to wait. He had been in desert country long enough to know that the longer the lull, the harder the blow when it finally came. A queer, flat light hung over everything. There was a large wooden cross nailed to the door of the place, which was leaning and tired. He rapped and waited. No answer. He rapped again. No answer. He drew back and kicked in the door with one hard shot of his right boot. A small bolt on the inside ripped free. The door banged against a haphazardly planked wall and scared rats into skittering flight. Sylvia Pitston sat in the hall, in a mammoth ironwood rocker, and looked at him calmly with those great and dark eyes. The stormlight fell on her cheeks in crazy half-tones. She wore a shawl. The rocker made tiny squeaking noises. They looked at each other for a long, clockless moment.
"You will never catch him," she said. "You walk in the way of evil."
"He came to you," the gunslinger said,
"and to my bed. He spoke to me in the tongue, the high speech. He
screwed you, in every sense of the word."
She did not flinch. "You walk an evil way, gunslinger. You stand in shadows. You stood in the shadows of the holy place last night. Did you think I couldn't see you?"
"Why did he heal the weed eater?"
"He's an angel of God. He said so."
"I hope he smiled when he said it." She drew her lip back from her teeth in an unconsciously feral gesture.
"He told me you would follow. He told me what to do. He said you are the Antichrist."
The gunslinger shook his head. "He didn't say that." She smiled up at him lazily.
"He said you would want to bed me. Is it true?"
"Did you ever meet a man who didn't want to bed you?"
"The price of my flesh would be your life, gunslinger. He has got me with child, not his, but the child of a great king. If you invade me..."
She let the lazy smile complete her thought. At the same time, she gestured with her huge, mountainous thighs. They stretched beneath her garment like pure marble slabs. The effect was dizzying. The gunslinger dropped his hands to the butts of his pistols. "You have a demon, woman, not a king. Yet fear not. I can remove it." The effect was instantaneous. She recoiled against the chair, and a weasel look flashed on her face.
"Don't touch me. Don't come near me. You dare not touch the bride of God."
"Want to bet?" the gunslinger said. He stepped toward her. As the gambler said when he laid down a handful of cups and wands, "Just watch me." The flesh on the huge frame quaked. Her face had become a caricature of terror, and she stabbed the sign of the eye at him with pronged fingers. "The desert," the gunslinger said. "What after the desert?"
"You'll never catch him. Never, never. You'll burn. He told me so."
"I'll catch him," the gunslinger said. "We both know it. What is beyond the desert?"
"No."
"Answer me."
"No."
He slid forward, dropped to his knees, and grabbed her thighs. Her legs locked like a vice. She made strange, lustful keening noises. "The demon, then," he said. "Out it comes."
"No."
He pried the legs apart and unholstered one of his guns.
"No, no, no."
Her breath came in short, savage grunts. "Answer me." She rocked in the chair, and the floor trembled. Prayers and garbled bits of scripture flew from her lips. He rammed the barrel of the gun forward. He could feel the terrified wind sucked into her lungs more than he could hear it. Her hands beat at his head. Her legs drummed against the floor, and at the same time, the huge body tried to suck the invader in. Outside, nothing watched them but the bruised and dusty sky. She screamed something, high and inarticulate.
"What?" "Mountains."
"What about them?"
"He stops on the other side. Sweet Jesus! To make his strength meditation. Do you understand? Oh,
The whole huge mountain of flesh suddenly strained forward and upward, yet he was careful not to let her secret flesh touch him. Then she seemed to wilt and grow smaller, and she wept with her hands in her lap.
So, he said, getting up. The demon is served, eh?
Get out. You've killed the child of the Crimson King. But you will be repaid. I set my watch and warrant on it. Now get out. Get out. He stopped at the door and looked back.
No child, he said briefly. No angel, prince, no demon.
Leave me alone.
He did.
XVI. By the time he arrived at Kennelly's, a queer obscurity had come over the northern horizon, and he knew it was dust. Over Tull, the air was still dead quiet. Kennelly was waiting for him on the chaff-strewn stage that was the floor of his barn.
Leaving?
He grinned abjectly at the gunslinger. Yeah.
Not before the storm.
Ahead of it.
The wind goes faster than any man on a mule. In the open, it can kill you.
I want the mule now, the gunslinger said simply.
Sure.
But Kennelly did not turn away, merely stood, as if searching for something further to say, grinning his groveling, hate-filled grin, and his eyes flicked up and over the gunslinger's shoulder. The gunslinger sidestepped and turned at the same time, and the heavy stick of stovewood that the girl Subi held swished through the air, grazing his elbow only. She lost hold of it with the force of her swing, and it clattered over the floor. In the explosive height of the loft, barn swallows took shadowed wing. The girl looked at him bovinely, her breasts thrust with overripe grandeur at the wash-faded shirt she wore. One thumb sought the haven of her mouth with dreamlike slowness. The gunslinger turned back to Kennelly. Kennelly's grin was huge. His skin was waxy yellow. His eyes rolled in their sockets.
Aye,
he began in a phlegm-filled whisper and could not continue. The mule, the gunslinger prodded gently.
Sure, sure, sure,
Kennelly whispered, the grin now touched with incredulity that he should still be alive. He shuffled to get it. The gunslinger moved to where he could watch the man go. The hostler brought the mule back and handed him the bridle.
You get it and tend your sister,
he said to Subi. Subi tossed her head and didn't move. The gunslinger left them there, staring at each other across the dusty, dropping-strewn floor, he with a sick grin, she with dumb, inanimate defiance. Outside, the heat was still like a hammer. 17. He walked the mule up the center of the street, his boots sending up squirts of dust. His water bags, swollen with water, were strapped across the mule's back. He stopped at the Tonk, but Allie was not there. The place was deserted, battened down for the storm, but still dirty from the night before. It stank of sour beer. He filled his tote sack with cornmeal, dried and roasted corn, and half of the raw hamburg in the cooler. He left 4 gold pieces stacked on the planked counter. Allie did not come down. Sheb's piano bid him a silent, yellow-toothed toodaloo. He stepped back out and cinched the tote sack across the mule's back. There was a tight feeling in his throat. He might still avoid the trap, but the chances were small. He was, after all, the interloper. He walked past the shuttered, waiting buildings, feeling the eyes that peered through cracks and chinks. The man in black had played God in Tull. He had spoken of a king's child, a red prince. Was it only a sense of the cosmic comic, or a matter of desperation? It was a question of some importance. There was a shrill, harried scream from behind him, and doors suddenly threw themselves open. Forms lunged. The trap was sprung. Men in long handles and men in dirty dungarees, women in slacks and in faded dresses, even children tagging after their parents, and in every hand there was a chunk of wood or a knife. His reaction was automatic, instantaneous, inbred. He whirled on his heels while his hands pulled the guns from their holsters, the butts heavy and sure in his hands. It was Allie. And of course it had to be Allie, coming at him with her face distorted, the scar a hellish purple in the lowering light. He saw that she was held hostage. The distorted, grimacing face of Sheb peered over her shoulder like a witch's familiar. She was his shield and sacrifice. He saw it all, clear and shadowless, in the frozen, deathless light of the sterile calm, and heard her.
"Kill me, Roland. Kill me. I said the word. 19, I said, and he told me. I can't bear it."
The hands were trained to give her what she wanted. He was the last of his breed, and it was not only his mouth that knew the high speech. The guns beat their heavy, atonal music into the air. Her mouth flapped, and she sagged, and the guns fired again. The last expression on her face might have been gratitude. Sheb's head snapped back. They both fell into the dust. "They've gone to the land of 19, he thought. "Whatever is there." Sticks flew through the air, rained on him. He staggered, fended them off. One with a nail pounded raggedly through it, ripped at his arm and drew blood. A man with a beard stubble and sweat-stained armpits lunged, flying at him with a dull kitchen knife held in one paw. The gunslinger shot him dead, and the man thumped into the street. His false teeth shot out as his chin struck and grinned, spit shiny in the dirt. "Satan!" someone was screaming. "The accursed! Bring him down!" "The interloper!" another voice cried. Sticks rained on him. A knife struck his boot and bounced. "The interloper! The Antichrist!" He blasted his way through the middle of them, running as the bodies fell, his hands picking the targets with ease and dreadful accuracy. Two men and a woman went down, and he ran through the hole they left. He led them a feverish parade across the street and toward the rickety general store barbershop that faced Sheb's. He mounted the boardwalk, turned again, and fired the rest of his loads into the charging crowd. Behind them, Sheb and Allie and the others lay crucified in the dust. They never hesitated or faltered, although every shot he fired found a vital spot, and they had probably never seen a gun. He retreated, moving his body like a dancer to avoid the flying missiles. He reloaded as he went, with a rapidity that had also been trained into his fingers. They shuttled busily between gun belts and cylinders. The mob came up over the boardwalk, and he stepped into the general store and rammed the door closed. The large display window to the right shattered inward, and three men crowded through. Their faces were zealously blank, their eyes filled with bland fire. He shot them all, and the two that followed them. They fell in the window, hung on the jutting shards of glass, choking the opening. The door crashed and shuddered with their weight, and he could hear her voice. "The killer! Your souls! The cloven hoof!" The door ripped off its hinges and fell straight in, making a flat hand clap. Dust puffed up from the floor. Men, women, and children charged him. Spittle and stove wood flew. He shot his guns empty, and they fell like ninepins in a game of points. He retreated into the barber shop, shoving over a flour barrel, rolling it at them, throwing a pan of boiling water that contained two nicked straight razors. They came on, screaming with frantic incoherency. From somewhere, Sylvia Pitston exhorted them, her voice rising and falling in blind inflections. He pushed shells into hot chambers, smelling the aromas of shave and tonsure, smelling his own flesh as the calluses at the tips of his fingers singed. He went through the back door and onto the porch. The flat scrubland was at his back now, flatly denying the town that crouched against its dirty haunch. Three men hustled around the corner with large betrayer grins on their faces. They saw him seeing them, and the grins curdled in the second before he mowed them down. A woman had followed them, howling. She was large and fat and known to the patrons of Sheb's as Aunt Mill. The gunslinger blew her backwards, and she landed in a whorish sprawl, her skirt rucked up between her thighs. He went down the steps and walked backwards into the desert, 10 paces, 20. The back door of the barber shop flew open, and they boiled out. He caught a glimpse of Sylvia Pitston. He opened up.
They fell in squats. They fell backwards. They tumbled over the railing into the dust. They cast no shadows in the deathless purple light of the day. He realized he was screaming. He had been screaming all along. His eyes felt like cracked ball bearings. His balls had drawn up against his belly. His legs were wood. His ears were iron. The guns were empty, and they boiled at him, transmogrified into an eye and a hand, and he stood, screaming and reloading, his mind far away and absent, letting his hands do their reloading trick. Could he hold up a hand, tell them he had spent 1,000 years learning this trick and others, tell them of the guns and the blood that had blessed them? Not with his mouth, but his hands could speak their own tale. They were in throwing range as he finished reloading, and a stick struck him on the forehead and brought blood in abraded drops. In 2 seconds they would be in gripping distance. In the forefront he saw Kennelly. Kennelly's younger daughter, perhaps 11, Subi, 2 male barflies, a whore named Amy Felden. He let them all have it, and the ones behind them. Their bodies thumped like scarecrows. Blood and brains flew in streamers. They halted for a moment, startled, the mob face shivering into individual, bewildered faces. A man ran in a large, screaming circle. A woman with blisters on her hands turned her head up and cackled feverishly at the sky. The man whom he had first seen sitting gravely on the steps of the mercantile store made a sudden and amazing load in his pants. He had time to reload one gun. Then it was Sylvia Pitston, running at him, waving a wooden cross in each hand. "Devil! Devil! Devil! Child killer! Monster! Destroy him, brothers and sisters! Destroy the child-killing interloper!" He put a shot into each of the cross pieces, blowing the roods to splinters, and 4 more into the woman's head. She seemed to accordion into herself and waver like a shimmer of heat. They all stared at her for a moment in tableau, while the gunslinger's fingers did their reloading trick. The tips of his fingers sizzled and burned. Neat circles were branded into the tips of each one. There were fewer of them now. He had run through them like a mower's scythe. He thought they would break with the woman dead, but someone threw a knife. The hilt struck him squarely between the eyes and knocked him over. They ran at him in a reaching, vicious clot. He fired his guns empty again, lying in his own spent shells. His head hurt, and he saw large brown circles in front of his eyes. He missed with one shot, downed 11 with the rest. But they were on him, the ones that were left. He fired the 4 shells he had reloaded, and then they were beating him, stabbing him. He threw a pair of them off his left arm and rolled away. His hands began doing their infallible trick. He was stabbed in the shoulder. He was stabbed in the back. He was hit across the ribs. He was stabbed in the ass with what might have been a meat fork. A small boy squirmed at him and made the only deep cut across the bulge of his calf. The gunslinger blew his head off. They were scattering, and he let them have it again, back shooting now. The ones left began to retreat toward the sand-colored pitted buildings, and still the hands did their business, like over-eager dogs that want to do their rolling-over trick for you, not once or twice, but all night, and the hands were cutting them down as they ran. The last one made it as far as the steps of the barbershop's back porch, and then the gunslinger's bullet took him in the back of the head. "Yelp!" the man cried, and fell over. It was Tull's final word on the business. Silence came back in, filling jagged spaces. The gunslinger was bleeding from perhaps 20 different wounds, all of them shallow except for the cut across his calf. He bound it with a strip of shirt, and then straightened and examined his kill. They trailed in a twisting, zigzagging path from the back door of the barbershop to where he stood. They lay in all positions. None of them seemed to be sleeping. He followed the trail of death, counting as he went. In the general store, one man sprawled with his arms wrapped lovingly around the cracked candy jar he had dragged down with him. He ended up where he had started, in the middle of the deserted main street. He had shot and killed 39 men, 14 women, and 5 children. He had shot and killed everyone in Tull. A sickish sweet odor came to him on the first of the dry, stirring wind. He followed it, then looked up and nodded. The decaying body of Nort was spread-eagled atop the plank roof of Sheb's, crucified with wooden pegs. Mouth and eyes were open,
the mark of a large and purple cloven hoof, had been pressed into the skin of his grimy forehead. The gunslinger walked out of town. His mule was standing in a clump of weed about 40 yards further along the remnant of the coach road. The gunslinger led it back to Kennelly's stable. Outside, the wind was playing a jag-time tune. He put the mule up for the time being and went back to the tonk. He found a ladder in the back shed, went up to the roof, and cut Nort loose. The body was lighter than a bag of sticks. He tumbled it down to join the common people, those who would only have to die once. Then he went back inside, ate hamburgers, and drank 3 beers while the light failed and the sand began to fly. That night he slept in the bed where he and Allie had lain. He had no dreams. The next morning the wind was gone, and the sun was its usual bright and forgetful self. The bodies had gone south like tumbleweeds with the wind. At mid-morning, after he had bound all his cuts, he moved on as well. 18. He thought Brown had fallen asleep. The fire was down to no more than a spark, and the bird Zoltan had put his head under his wing. Just as he was about to get up and spread a pallet in the corner, Brown said, "There! You've told it. Do you feel better?" The gunslinger started. "Why would I feel bad?" "You're human," you said. "No demon. Or did you lie?"
"I didn't lie."
He felt the grudging admittance in him. He liked Brown, honestly did, and he hadn't lied to the dweller in any way.
"Who are you, Brown? Really, I mean."
"Just me," he said, unperturbed. "Why do you have to think you're in the middle of such a mystery?" The gunslinger lit a smoke without replying. "I think you're very close to your man in black," Brown said. "Is he desperate?"
"I don't know."
"Are you?"
"Not yet," the gunslinger said.
He looked at Brown with a shade of defiance.
"I go where I have to go. Do what I have to do."
"That's good, then," Brown said, and turned over and went to sleep. 19. The next morning, Brown fed him and sent him on his way. In the daylight, he was an amazing figure with his scrawny, sunburnt chest, pencil-like collarbones, and loony shock of red hair, the bird perched on his shoulder. "The mule?" the gunslinger asked.
"I'll eat it," Brown said.
"Okay."
Brown offered his hand, and the gunslinger shook it. The dweller nodded to the southeast.
"Walk easy. Long days and pleasant nights.
May you have twice the number."
They nodded at each other, and then the man Allie had called Roland walked away, his body festooned with guns and water. He looked back once. Brown was rooting furiously at his little corn bed. The crow was perched on the low roof of his dwelling, like a gargoyle. 20. The fire was down, and the stars had begun to pale off. The wind walked restlessly, told its tale to no one. The gunslinger twitched in his sleep and was still again. He dreamed a thirsty dream. In the darkness, the shape of the mountains was invisible. Any thoughts of guilt, any feelings of regret had faded. The desert had baked them out. He found himself thinking more and more about Cort, who had taught him to shoot. Cort had known black from white. He stirred again and woke. He blinked at the dead fire with its own shape superimposed over the other, more geometrical one. He was a romantic, he knew it, and he guarded the knowledge jealously. It was a secret he had shared with only a few over the years. The girl named Susan, the girl from Edgis, had been one of them. That, of course, made him think of Cort again. Cort was dead. They were all dead.
except for him. The world had moved on. The gunslinger shouldered his gunner and moved on with it. Chapter 2. The Way Station. 1. A nursery rhyme had been playing itself through his mind all day, the maddening kind of thing that will not let go, that mockingly ignores all commands of the conscious mind to cease and desist. The rhyme was, "The rain in Spain falls on the plain. There is joy and also pain, but the rain in Spain falls on the plain. Time's a sheet, life's a stain. All the things we know will change, and all those things remain the same. But be ye mad or only sane, the rain in Spain falls on the plain. We walk in love, but fly in chains, and the plains in Spain fall in the rain." He didn't know what a plane was in the context of the rhyme's last couplet, but knew why the rhyme had occurred to him in the first place. There had been the recurring dream of his room in the castle, and of his mother, who had sung it to him as he lay solemnly in a tiny bed by the window of many colors. She did not sing it at bedtimes, because all small boys born to the high speech must face the dark alone. But she sang to him at nap times, and he could remember the heavy gray rain light that shivered into rainbows on the counterpane. He could feel the coolness of the room and the heavy warmth of blankets, love for his mother and her red lips, the haunting melody of the little nonsense lyric, and her voice. Now it came back maddeningly, like a dog chasing its own tail in his mind as he walked. All his water was gone, and he knew he was very likely a dead man. He had never expected it to come to this, and he was sorry. Since noon he had been watching his feet rather than the way ahead. Out here, even the devil grass had grown stunted and yellow. The hard pan had disintegrated in places to mere rubble. The mountains were not noticeably clearer, although 16 days had passed since he had left the hut of the last homesteader, a loony, sane young man on the edge of the desert. He had had a bird, the gunslinger remembered, but he couldn't remember the bird's name. He watched his feet move up and down like the heddles of a loom, listened to the nonsense rhyme sing itself into a pitiful garble in his mind, and wondered when he would fall down for the first time. He didn't want to fall. Even though there was no one to see him, it was a matter of pride. A gunslinger knows pride, that invisible bone that keeps the neck stiff. What hadn't come to him from his father had been kicked into him by Court, a boy's gentleman if there ever was one. Court, yeah, with his red bulb of a nose and his scarred face. He stopped and looked up suddenly. It made his head buzz, and for a moment his whole body seemed to float. The mountains dreamed against the far horizon, but there was something else up ahead, something much closer, perhaps only 5 miles away. He squinted at it, but his eyes were sandblasted and going glare-blind. He shook his head and began to walk again. The rhyme circled and buzzed. About an hour later he fell down and skinned his hands. He looked at the tiny beads of blood on his flaked skin with disbelief. The blood looked no thinner. It looked like any blood, now dying in the air. It seemed almost as smug as the desert. He dashed the drops away, hating them blindly. Smug? Why not? The blood was not thirsty. The blood was being served. The blood was being made sacrifice unto. Blood sacrifice. All the blood needed to do was run. And run. And run. He looked at the splotches that had landed on the hard pan and watched as they were sucked up with uncanny suddenness. How do you like that, blood? How does that suit you? Oh, Jesus, I'm far gone. He got up, holding his hands to his chest. And the thing he'd seen earlier was almost in front of him, so close it made him cry out, a dust-choked crow croak. It was a building, no, two buildings, surrounded by a fallen rail fence. The wood seemed old, fragile to the point of elvishness.
It was wood being transmogrified into sand. One of the buildings had been a stable. The shape was clear and unmistakable. The other was a house, or an inn, a way station for the coach line. The tottering sand house, the wind had crusted the wood with grit until it looked like a sand castle that the sun had beat upon at low tide and hardened to a temporary abode, cast a thin line of shadow, and someone sat in the shadow, leaning against the building, and the building seemed to lean with the burden of his weight. Him, then. At last. The man in black. The gunslinger stood with his hands to his chest, unaware of his declamatory posture, and gawped. But instead of the tremendous winging excitement he had expected, or perhaps fear or awe, there was nothing but the dim atavistic guilt for the sudden raging hate of his own blood moments earlier, and the endless ring arosy of the childhood song, The Rain in Spain. He moved forward, drawing one gun. Falls on the plain. He came the last quarter mile at a jolting, flat-footed run, not trying to hide himself. There was nothing to hide behind. His short shadow raced him. He was not aware that his face had become a gray and dusty death mask of exhaustion. He was aware of nothing but the figure in the shadow. It did not occur to him until later that the figure might even have been dead. He kicked through one of the leaning fence rails, it broke in two without a sound, almost apologetically, and lunged across the dazzled and silent stable yard, bringing the gun up. "You're covered! You're covered! Hands up, you whoreson! You're—" The figure moved restlessly and stood up. The gunslinger thought, "My God, he is worn away to nothing. What's happened to him?" Because the man in black had shrunk 2 full feet, and his hair had gone white. He paused, struck dumb, his head buzzing tunelessly. His heart was racing at a lunatic rate, and he thought, "I'm dying right here." He sucked the white-hot air into his lungs and hung his head for a moment. When he raised it again, he saw it wasn't the man in black, but a boy with sun-bleached hair, regarding him with eyes that did not even seem interested. The gunslinger stared at him blankly and then shook his head in negation. But the boy survived his refusal to believe. He was a strong delusion, one wearing blue jeans with a patch on one knee and a plain brown shirt of rough weave. The gunslinger shook his head again and started for the stable with his head lowered, gun still in hand. He couldn't think yet. His head was filled with motes, and there was a huge, thrumming ache building in it. The inside of the stable was silent and dark and exploding with heat. The gunslinger stared around himself with huge, floating wall eyes. He made a drunken about face and saw the boy standing in the ruined doorway, staring at him. A blade of pain slipped smoothly into his head, cutting from temple to temple, dividing his brain like an orange. He reholstered his gun, swayed, put out his hands as if to ward off phantoms, and fell over on his face. Two. When he woke up, he was on his back, and there was a pile of light, odorless hay beneath his head. The boy had not been able to move him, but he had made him reasonably comfortable, and he was cool. He looked down at himself and saw that his shirt was dark and wet. He looked at his face and tasted water. He blinked at it. His tongue seemed to swell in his mouth. The boy was hunkered down beside him. When he saw the gunslinger's eyes were open, he reached behind him and gave the gunslinger a dented tin can filled with water. He grasped it with trembling hands and allowed himself to drink a little, just a little. When that was down and sitting in his belly, he drank a little more. Then he spilled the rest over his face and made shocked, blowing noises. The boy's pretty lips curved in a solemn little smile. "Would you want something to eat, sir?" "Not yet," the gunslinger said. There was still a sick ache in his head from the sunstroke,
and the water sat uneasily in his stomach, as if it did not know where to go.
Who are you?
My name is John Chambers. You can call me Jake. I have a friend, well, sort of a friend. She works for us, who calls me Bama sometimes, but you can call me Jake.
The gunslinger sat up, and the sick ache became hard and immediate. He leaned forward and lost a brief struggle with his stomach.
"There's more," Jake said.
He took the can and walked toward the rear of the stable. He paused and smiled back at the gunslinger uncertainly. The gunslinger nodded at him and then put his head down and propped it with his hands. The boy was well made, handsome, perhaps 10 or 11. There had been a shadow of fear on his face, but that was all right. The gunslinger would have trusted him far less if the boy hadn't shown fear. A strange thumping hum began at the rear of the stable. The gunslinger raised his head alertly, hands going to the butts of his guns. The sound lasted for perhaps 15 seconds and then quit. The boy came back with the can, filled now. The gunslinger drank sparingly again, and this time it was a little better. The ache in his head was fading.
"I didn't know what to do with you when you fell down," Jake said. "For a couple of seconds there, I thought you were going to shoot me."
"Maybe I was. I thought you were somebody else."
"The priest?"
The gunslinger looked up sharply. The boy studied him, frowning.
"He camped in the yard. I was in the house over there. Or maybe it was a depot. I didn't like him, so I didn't come out. He came in the night and went on the next day. I would have hidden from you, but I was sleeping when you came."
He looked darkly over the gunslinger's head.
"I don't like people. They fuck me up."
"What did he look like?"
The boy shrugged.
"Like a priest. He was wearing black things.
A hood and a cassock?"
"What's a cassock?"
"A robe, like a dress."
The boy nodded.
"That's about right."
The gunslinger leaned forward, and something in his face made the boy recoil a little.
"How long ago? Tell me, for your father's sake."
I...
Patiently, the gunslinger said, "I'm not going to hurt you."
"I don't know. I can't remember time. Every day is the same."
For the first time, the gunslinger wondered consciously how the boy had come to this place, with dry and man-killing leagues of desert all around it. But he would not make it his concern, not yet, at least. "Make your best guess. Long ago?"
"No, not long. I haven't been here long."
The fire lit in him again. He snatched up the can and drank from it with hands that trembled the smallest bit. A fragment of the cradle song recurred, but this time, instead of his mother's face, he saw the scarred face of Alice, who had been his Jilly in the now-defunct town of Tull. "A week? Two? Three?" The boy looked at him distractedly.
"Yes."
"Which?"
"A week? Or two?"
He looked aside, blushing a little.
"Three poops ago. That's the only way I can measure things now." "He didn't even drink. I thought he might be the ghost of a priest, like in this movie I saw once, only Zorro figured out he wasn't a priest at all, or a ghost either. He was just a banker who wanted some land because there was gold on it. Mrs. Shaw took me to see that movie. It was in Times Square."
None of this made any sense to the gunslinger, so he did not comment on it.
"I was scared," the boy said. "I've been scared almost all the time."
His face quivered like crystal on the edge of the ultimate destructive high note.
"He didn't even build a fire. He just sat there. I don't even know if he went to sleep."